doing it, if for no other reason than to derail whatever theories they'd constructed around Bramwell.
Right. And Spencer was where?
I honestly couldn't recall exactly what had happened to Spencer. The last thing I remembered was that he'd jogged off toward the mausoleum. He took off.
He left you there, to be attacked by this man in a bird mask.
Yes. I don't know where Spencer ran off to, but he wasn't there to help.
But you claim Professor Bramwell heard you scream and came to your aid.
Yes, he fought the Birdman. Even if I hadn't actually seen that happen, I had to admit I enjoyed the fantasy of it.
Right. And in the meantime, you escaped back to your dorm.
As much as I'd have loved to end the story there, I couldn't tell him that. There were cameras posted outside of every dorm. He'd have surely called me out on the lie right then and there. No, I wasn't feeling well when I left the party. I ended up passing out. Professor Bramwell carried me to his car, intending to drive me back to my dorm.
But?
I threw up in his car, and I was humiliated. I asked him to pull over, and that's when I jumped out and ran.
To where?
The chapel. After speaking to Professor Bramwell, I knew the chapel had no cameras posted outside. Apparently, Jesus didn't like spies, and that was fine with me. It also happened to be the only building left unlocked that late at night. After what happened, I was horribly shaken and scared. I hid in the pews of the chapel all night and prayed.
Uh-huh.
The disbelieving tone of his voice matched the look he gave me right then.
But you did not report this to campus police.
No, I know it was wrong, and I should have. Gaze lowered to my lap, I fidgeted with my hands, wondering if any of my lies sounded remotely believable. Were victims allowed to be disputed, or was that just an unspoken rule? But I'm reporting it to you now.
I've spoken with Spencer. He did say you weren't feeling well when you left, and that you did, in fact, see a figure in the gardens. Where your stories differ is the part where he ran away. He says something or someone attacked him.
Of course he did. It was almost artistic, the way Spencer manipulated stories. If I had had even the slightest doubt about what had happened between him and Mel, my situation surely cemented it in my head that the guy was shady. As I said, I can't recall where Spencer ran off to.
He claims it was Professor Bramwell who attacked and knocked him out.
The urge to choke out a laugh wobbled in my throat. All that came to mind were the few times throughout the night when I'd talked to Professor Bramwell and noticed Spencer's disapproving scowl. That's absurd. I specifically saw Professor Bramwell fight off the man in the mask. Spencer ran off.
Spencer does have injuries that support his claim. A rather unpleasant-looking black eye.
And what, because I don't, my claims are dismissed?
Well, I didn't say that.
Langmore threw up his hands and shook his head, clearly uncomfortable with my rebuttal.
Those words did not come out of my mouth, Miss Vespertine.
I have reason to believe I was drugged, sir. The moment I said the words, his mouth clamped shut.
Perhaps you should consider testing.
I was given Knox berries, a known hallucinogenic. I suspect that Spencer gave me the drug. I'd avoided the accusation up until that point, because accusing Spencer would have undoubtedly made my life all the more complicated. He was Lippincott's son, and Lippincott happened to be the keeper of my scholarship. As the provost, he held the ultimate decision whether or not I'd be permitted to continue my education at Dracadia. And considering that I'd finally gained an opportunity to find out what had really happened to my mother, I didn't want to screw that up by pissing him off. Yes, the right thing to do would have been reporting Spencer, but I kinda lacked evidence at that point. And getting myself kicked out of Dracadia over speculation would have pissed me off. I accepted a drink from him earlier in the night. I'm sure there are a number of witnesses from the gala I attended who can attest. Unfortunately, urine tests won't pick up on Knox berries.
You're certain that you were given Knox berries?
Of course not. The only one who could confirm that is Professor Bramwell, but at this point you might deem that a conflict of interest, based on Spencer's accusations. So why don't we do this? Since I am the victim in this situation, having to admit that, to actually say the V word, burned like acid on my tongue. In my own quiet space, I'd deal with the anger of having been drugged. And since my suspicions led me to believe it was Spencer, I'd make a point to keep my distance from him. In the interest of not rousing a bunch of scandal, I won't press charges against Spencer. I will avoid him, as I should have from the beginning. You have my report on the man in the mask. Perhaps you might put your efforts into him, since I'm telling you he is the one who attacked me. Unfortunately, he'd be chasing thin air with the lead. And while I felt slightly bad for leading him on that goose chase, I didn't need Spencer throwing Bramwell under the bus, particularly after I'd negotiated a pretty sweet deal with the professor. Not to mention, Spencer knew damned well that Bramwell hadn't attacked him. The whole situation felt a little vindictive, if anything, especially considering Spencer still harbored animosity about his friend getting kicked out. It wouldn't have surprised me if the guy had given himself that black eye, like something straight out of Fight Club.
Are you certain of this, Miss Vespertine? We do not take these attacks lightly. I want you to feel supported in your account of what happened.
I'm certain. We'll consider this a wash. I'll be much more careful not to venture out at night. Ugh, that went entirely against my femininity, but I held on to the fact that it was for a good cause. I had the opportunity I'd been waiting for to learn more about my mother's illness, and I had no intentions of getting wrapped up in Spencer's vengeful little web as a distraction.
Very well. We will pursue this masked man in the meantime, for the sake of campus safety, and I would ask that you report any additional concerns directly to me.
Of course. Chapter 42. Lilia. The cadaver entrance was an old brick tunnel with two points of entry. The door outside the university gate, which would have left me dealing with the tyrannical gatekeeper and made the whole point of remaining unseen pointless. Or the door leading to the incinerator room that was connected to the cadaver tunnel. Neither entrance had cameras. Both were creepy as hell, particularly at night. A chill racked my body as I walked through the open space, carrying nothing more than the flashlight on my phone. To the left stood six steel doors, like old ovens, and beneath them, smaller sliding doors, which I guessed held the flames used to burn the bodies. A charred ash scent on the air told me one had been used recently. Casting that thought to the back of my mind, I hustled through the room to a full-sized door, which spat me into the halfway mark of the cadaver tunnel, an arched brick tunnel, the ends of which were shrouded in darkness, like something out of a horror movie. The temperature inside the tunnel had to have been 10 degrees cooler, the crisp bite of cold gnawing on my bones. A few more feet ahead and the tunnel opened onto the autopsy room, with its stainless steel beds, sinks, scales, and white-tiled floors, and a steel door to the left that led to the refrigerator, where med school cadavers were stored. If possible, the room was even colder than the tunnel, with a sterile bleach scent that burned my sinuses and overpowered the faint whiff of formalin. I only vaguely remembered the path based on the quick introduction I'd gotten when Professor Bramwell had whisked me out of there earlier that morning. The cells where I'd awakened were down some other obscure tunnel that I probably couldn't have found again if I'd tried. I kept on through the autopsy room, to the lab door where I punched in a code he'd given me on the keypad beside it. A red light on the keypad flicked to green, and the door clicked, allowing me to push through into a wide open space with wooden benches and microscopes, stacked books, and walls of bookshelves. Candles flickered in lanterns and large hurricanes throughout the room, and, like in the midnight lab, tanks around the room gave off a soft purple glow. I passed one that housed dozens of worms, squirming across the tank floor. Far more than those in the lab upstairs. Rows of shelves housed specimen jars in which unidentifiable objects sat suspended in what I presumed to be formalin. Amidst the old, outdated echoes of a lab from the 1800s, were a few modern amenities sprinkled in. Two large steel refrigerators, a centrifuge, incubators, scales, and fume hoods. A strange clash of old and new that left me scratching my head. Surely the university could have afforded to outfit such an important project, particularly given the extravagant gala I'd just attended. Professor Bramwell breezed through the door at the other end of the lab, which led to his office, wearing a long white lab coat and a pair of goggles cocked up on his head. On seeing me, he skidded to a stop. The frown on his face gave me the impression that he hadn't actually expected me to show up. I cleared my throat, wearing a sheepish smile, and waved. Grumbling to himself, he kept on toward one of the benches, and as I stepped in that direction to follow him, he pointed toward the door from where he'd just come.
My office.
Nerves humming with intimidation, I obeyed his command and made my way toward his office. Through the door, I came upon another small corridor, with three closed doors and one ajar. At the end of the hallway flashed an exit sign, which I guessed led to the staircase that opened up on the midnight lab above us. A much more sophisticated laboratory. With curious steps, I entered the moderately sized office, where the scent of leather, polished wood, and old books mingled on the air along with the mouth-watering echoes of his cologne. If the lab was the heartbeat of his research, this room was the brain, given all of the medical and parasitology references that lined the bookshelves on each wall. Sketches of human anatomy lay scattered on the coffee table as I sauntered past it. My gaze fawned over the exquisitely carved cherry wood desk, gleaming in the dim light. Behind it, a vintage-looking record player in a wooden cabinet sat with the lid cocked open. And above that, on the wall hung a plaque with the Latin phrase, Mortui vivos docent. I recognized it from a forensics class I'd taken 2 semesters ago. The dead teach the living. Unlike his office in the admin wing, this one held more amenities, which gave the impression he spent more time here. A small refrigerator, a leather couch, an ottoman with a blanket draped over the arm, a small fireplace radiating a cozy warmth, and a standing coat rack where an umbrella had been hooked. Like the lab, his office held skulls of various sizes, jars of strange objects, dissected organs and bones from what I could make out. A full-sized human skeleton stood propped on a stand. Books claimed space everywhere I looked in perfect stacks. 2 microscopes. Candles flickering in large hurricanes. Something brushed across my ankles, and on a panicked jolt, I leapt onto Professor Bramwell's desk. Twisting around showed a black little furball staring up at me with golden eyes. I blew out a relieved breath and chuckled, climbing off the desk. "Hello there," I said, kneeling down to give the cat a pet. "What the heck are you doing in a lab?" I frowned the moment the words escaped me. "He better not be experimenting on you." The cat leaned into the scratching and I smiled, indulging the attention-loving rascal. Strange. He doesn't strike me as a cat person. Footsteps alerted me to his approach, and I abandoned the cat and scurried toward one of the chairs at his desk, plopping down just before he entered the room. Crossing toward his desk, Professor Bramwell removed his lab coat and goggles, hung them neatly on the coat rack, and slid into his chair. The tight fit of his dress shirt certainly didn't go unnoticed as he sat forward, resting his elbow on the desktop. With an unreadable expression, he stared at me for a moment.
"I understand you spoke with Dean Langmore."
"I did."
"What did you tell him?"
I shifted in my seat because the man's gaze felt like hot laser beams across my skin. "That you tried to help me, but I ran off? Humiliated for having thrown up in your car?"
"To the church, I presume."
"Yes."
"Good."
Leaning back in his chair, he steepled his fingers, not bothering to direct his laser beams somewhere else.
"You'll don a lab coat every time you enter the lab. I'll be sure to have them available to you in the autopsy room. Gloves and goggles are also required."
"Okay. Can I ask you a question?" Though he didn't make a sound, his unamused expression told me he was inwardly groaning. "Why does this lab look like something out of the Dark Ages?"
"The specimens you've worked with in the Midnight Lab are newly infected. Those in this lab are in their tertiary phase and happen to have a rather intense sensitivity to light. We'll also be working with adult Noctosoma, which also possesses a very intense aversion to anything that isn't natural light."
"They can survive in the sunlight, then?"
"They can, although they're nocturnal and prefer night."
His comment brought an observation to mind. "My mother, she hardly slept at night. Do you think the worms affected that?"
"Well, I have no idea what may have caused your mother's insomnia, seeing as you claim she wasn't from the island or had never been here. But yes, they can affect circadian rhythms. As for the outdated state of the lab, I have plenty of equipment in the 3 other labs throughout this building. I'd much prefer to concentrate funds into the actual study versus giving this particular lab a makeover. It suits its purpose."
Definitely touchy about the lab. "Of course, I meant no disrespect. The labs upstairs were certainly well-equipped. I just hadn't expected to be working in a crypt. Probably fitting, though, for a moniker like Dr. Death.
Have you ever worked in a lab outside of your degree requirements?
He asked. Briefly? A mycology lab when I first graduated high school. It was basically just counting spores through a microscope.
Then perhaps you have a very basic understanding of lab etiquette and safety.
Except for the times my colleague and I would spray down the benchtops with alcohol that we ultimately lit on fire. Sure.
No food or drink. Practice good hygiene. Do not sniff or taste. And for God's sake, don't use your mouth as a pipette.
No one actually does that, do they? Brow cocked, he let out a sound of exasperation and reached for a to-go cup on his desk, with the infamous gold dragon label of the Dragon's Lair coffee shop.
I'll also have you assist in the occasional autopsy. Do you have any experience with cadavers, Miss Vespertine?
He kept his eyes on mine as he sipped his drink. No.
Then you will follow my direction without a fuck ton of questions. I like quiet when I work. Observe and you will learn.
Yes, sir.
I will give you 2 hours each night. You will be compensated in cash, as requested.
I scratched the curious itch at the back of my neck. May I ask what the compensation will be?
$200 a week. You will clean dishes and keep the lab tidy. You will not nose around.
Jesus. $200 a week. I'd expected a meager 50 at most. While I certainly appreciated the paycheck, the bigger benefit would be learning about the organism itself. I needed to understand its mechanisms better, the details that weren't expected to be covered until next semester, according to his syllabus. By gaining knowledge on the worm, perhaps the progression of my mother's sickness would make more sense. I understand.
There are 3 other rooms in this quarter. They are off-limits.
Which, of course, only piqued my curiosity. Even so, I answered, I understand.
Good. Let's begin.
For the first hour, I followed closely behind him as he acquainted me with all of the different machinery throughout the lab. Some I was already familiar with, like the microtome, centrifuge, and flow cytometer. Others, like the organ bath, were new to me. He also introduced me to a moderately sized steel structure, the autoclave, where I'd be expected to sterilize instruments and auger. As he led me toward the host of different microscopes out on a table, I paused at the shelf where I'd first noticed the strange specimen in formalin. Chunks of unidentifiable dissections of meat and bone lined 4 shelves, each with tiny labels. Gaucher disease, staghorn calculus, fibrous dysplasia. Conditions that I made a mental note to look up once back at my dorm.
Medical oddities I've stumbled upon,
Professor Bramwell said from behind.
The human body is a magnificent puzzle.
It must be fascinating to open the body and look inside. It was strange, the way he collected from the dead in much the same way I did with trinkets. It made me wonder if he did so for the same reasons as my own, if harvesting a piece of them in jars as he did kept the nightmares away.
You don't find this grotesque?
He asked, staring off at his wall of trophies. Yes, of course, but that's what makes it fascinating. I want to learn based on that curiosity.
You are a curiosity in yourself, Miss Vespertine.
After a brief introduction to the histological exams I'd be studying, he set me to work on chores. Small petri dishes lined the bench as I poured auger into them while silently grumbling to myself. Although I appreciated an easy start, I hoped to get my hands dirty with the nitty-gritty. Across from me, Professor Bramwell sat with his back to me, peering into a microscope. May I ask a question?
That is a phrase that will echo in death,
he said, not bothering to look up, and I smiled. Why moths? Aside from them being the natural host, why use them to study a toxin in humans?
Because they're cheaper than human beings, and it's not considered murder when they die.
I let out a snorty chuckle, spilling some of the auger onto the plastic mat beneath it.
They also happen to have a similar immune response.
Really? What is it about the toxin and human response?
You're delving into toddlerhood with all of these questions.
It was the flat tone of his voice that struck me as amusing. Not that I wanted to annoy him by any means. It somehow seemed to come natural between the two of us. I'm just trying to understand the nature of the research I'll be assisting with.
While you may be aware of the negative aspects of infection, Noctosoma happens to have a number of benefits.
Such as? He let out a huff, and I lowered my gaze to hide the smile cracking at the seams.
You claim your mother was infected. Tell me, prior to the week of her death, did she ever complain of illness, pain, or something as benign as indigestion?
Not that I recall, no. In fact, she'd suffered with arthritis in her hands for years, but I don't recall her complaining much about it then. Lifting his face from the eyepiece, he swapped samples from those out on the bench and peered through the microscope again.
If that's true, it's interesting, particularly in the case of her arthritis.
Why?
The organism cleanses the body. It removes all other pathogens.
His voice carried the drawl of his trying to focus the lens as he talked.
And in the case of arthritis, it redirects the immune system and keeps it from attacking the joints.
So it's a possible cure for autoimmune diseases.
The possibility is there. The methodology is an endless maze. For now, my focus is more narrowly concentrated.
I shook my head, imagining all of the diseases that would have fallen under that umbrella. This project is huge.
An understatement.
Then why do it yourself? It seems you'd require a team to carry that out.
As I'm sure you've discovered, I don't get along well with others. And I first have to establish and prove that the toxin holds potential.
I nibbled my lip, debating whether or not to ask the next question. I understand your father was a professor and researcher as well. Did he study Noctisoma? He twisted around in his chair, away from the scope.
Are you finished pouring the agar?
He asked, ignoring my question. Yes.
Good. You may leave.
I still have 20 minutes. Is there something else you'd like me to do?
No, that will be all. Careful walking back to your dorm.
With that, he turned back toward his microscope. Disappointed, I let out a huff and I slinked past him toward the autopsy room.
Miss Vespertine, wait.
Mid-stride, I turned back around.
I'll walk you to the campus bus stop. It's a fairly dark path at night.
He pushed up from his seat, and I had to turn back around so he wouldn't see the alarm flashing across my eyeballs. I can handle it. I've walked worse.
I'm certain you have, but as you are now a liability for me, I insist.
A liability? What the hell did that even mean? Even if I refused to admit it, I was a bit relieved to not have to walk solo through the creepy incinerator room. As he removed his coat, it seemed to catch on his shirt, pulling the collar down just enough that I managed a peek of the grisly scars across his collarbone and shoulder, the ones that still held the raw pink coloring of a recent wound. I tried to wrap my head around what had given his attacker the balls to throw acid, of all things. The abrupt pause of his movements caught my attention, and I glanced up to see him staring back at me. Clearing my throat, I removed my own coat, and after hanging it with his own on the hook outside the lab, he strode ahead of me, like he was leading me out instead of accompanying me. I jogged to catch up, walking alongside him through the dark tunnels. How are you not creeped out when you leave at night?
I have a reputation as Dr. Death. Seems most would be frightened of me.
I suppose. Though I don't find you all that frightening. Grouchy, but not frightening. He slid me an unamused glance.
My grouchy nature serves a purpose, Miss Vespertine. Unfortunately, you seem to have some inexplicable resistance.
I smiled, ignoring the crematory ovens as we passed by them en route to the exit. I like to arrive at my own conclusions about people.
Admirable. Though not entirely wise when the warnings are legitimate.
Legitimate? Like murder legitimate or just a play on the fact that he hung out with corpses? Are you confessing something, Professor? He skidded to a halt, the exit just up ahead of us.
Ask me.
What?
You're dying to ask me. You were staring at my scars just a moment ago. If I wanted to kill one of my students, I certainly have all the tools at my disposal.
He glanced over his shoulder toward where the oven stood as an ominous reminder of how quickly he could eliminate the evidence. Am I foolish for thinking you didn't kill her?
Well, I don't know. Are you?
What I've learned doesn't point to you killing her. But you did invite her to your lab.
I did not invite her. She apparently came in through the incinerator room while I was in the upper lab gathering some samples. I suspect she realized there was no getting past the code to the lab and abandoned her quest, whatever it may have been.
Arms crossed, he let out an exasperated breath.
It wasn't until the next morning that I learned of her disappearance, and by then I'd already been labeled a murderer.
I didn't know Jenny Herrick, but based on the interactions I'd had with Professor Bramwell, that story sounded like the most plausible of any I'd heard so far. It was sickening to think how quickly everyone had arrived at the conclusion of murder, particularly without any evidence that she'd been killed at all. "I don't believe you're a murderer." His brow winged up, and he strode off in the direction of the exit.
And so the moth befriended the flame.
"Huh," I said, falling into step after him. I didn't think the flame was capable of being friendly.
"You assume I'm the danger to you."
Smiling, I lifted my bag up onto my shoulder. "Well, I suppose you would have locked me in that cell if that were true."
"I suppose I still can. But it'd be a shame to cage a specimen, so..."
"Intriguing."
"Annoying. Truly, you'd make the worst captive in the history of kidnappings. A pack of howler monkeys would cause less headache."
He pushed the door open, allowing me to exit first. The heavy door slammed behind us as we made our way over the small hill toward the open yard where the road stood about 100 yards away. Is it wrong that I'm insulted by that? I let out a laugh and turned to see a smile stretch his lips. A true and genuine smile. And holy shit, it was the most beautiful smile I'd ever seen. Straight white teeth and a dimple in his cheek. I wished I could have captured it, but it faded as quickly as it arrived, and I watched as his brows tightened and a look of panic claimed his face. He bent forward, his hands balled into tight fists, and he let out a grunt. When he collapsed to the ground, adrenaline exploded through my veins, and I dropped my phone, collapsing next to him. "Professor!" Teeth clenched, he trembled and shook. But it wasn't like the seizure he'd had a while back. His eyes locked on mine, pleading in a way that clawed at my heart. I didn't know what to do. "I'll call for help," I said, scrambling for my fallen phone.
"No."
He reached out and grabbed my arm, his warm palm crushing my forearm as he held on to me. Eyes screwed shut, he kept hold, as his body shook and trembled and he grunted and gasped. His lips moved as he whispered something I couldn't hear at first, until his face twisted up and his body bowed as if he'd been struck by a jolt of electricity.
"Impervious."
That word again. I'd heard it the last time he'd suffered one of these seizures. I didn't move or try to wriggle from him. There'd surely be a bruise there tomorrow, but I didn't care as I watched him suffer through whatever had hooked itself into him. "Call someone," my head urged, his refusal for help echoing the times my mother had refused. "Call now." As I lifted my phone to dial campus emergency, the grip of my arm loosened. I looked back to see the tension in his face softening. His body trembled less as he exhaled through his nose. Eyes still closed, he seemed to calm, and the brush of something on my forearm was his thumb stroking me. Back and forth, back and forth. When he opened his eyes, there appeared an almost intoxicated serenity before it morphed before my eyes. The laxity in his face hardened again, and he released me, kicking back as he jolted upright. Gaze diverted from mine, he scowled, patting his chest in slacks and fished out a silver case that housed cigarettes. "Are you okay?" Shoving the cigarette between his lips, he patted again and pulled out a lighter, igniting the end of his smoke. One long drag and he rested his elbow on his bent knee, pinching the bridge of his nose.
"I suspect you're good to walk the rest of the way to your stop."
"I'm not leaving until I know you're all right."
"I'm fine."
He waved me off.
"Now please, go."
"No." The look he shot me was one I'd have expected if I slapped him. "I'll wait a few minutes, for my own peace of mind." Dropping my bag beside him, I plopped down on the grass that had gotten significantly colder in the last few hours. "You have a condition?"
"No shit,"
he said, and took another drag of his smoke. "What is it?"
"Vonerick's disease. A rare congenital disorder. Happy?"
"An autoimmune disease."
"Yes."
Just like that, it became clear to me why the man was so dedicated, so single-mindedly passionate about a bunch of freaking worms. "That's why you're working on the toxin. But I thought you said your work focused on diabetes. Is this a diabetic complication?"
"No. It so happens the mechanism is similar, Unfortunately, no one gives a fuck about a disease that only affects 1 in 500,000 people.
I wanted to ask him if his father had set out to study the same thing, but didn't want him shutting me out again. Is it? I clamped my mouth shut, not wanting to say it.
Deadly? Yes. If it reaches my heart, it's game over for me.
God, the sound of that had such a swiftness to it. The thought that I'd almost witnessed his death twice had my stomach flipping on itself. What is impervious? His brow flickered.
It's nothing.
Cigarette dangling from his fingertips, he rubbed his face against his outstretched bicep.
My apologies for putting my hand on you.
No need to apologize. I'm happy my arm was here. Flinching, I shook my head. God, scratch that comment altogether. What a stupid thing to say. So this toxin, how do you know it affects autoimmunity like that?
It's been demonstrated in mice.
You said earlier that you have to prove the toxin holds potential. Doesn't its effect in mice prove it?
It does.
Another drag of his cigarette, and he smashed it into the grass.
Unfortunately, death is a major fucking potential side effect. Until I can isolate a stable toxin variant, I'm stuck studying moths.
Here, I thought you liked studying moths, the way you carry on in your lectures.
Depends on the moth I'm studying.
Eyes on me, he pushed to his feet, stumbling back a step. Head winding through whether or not he'd just flirted again, I absent-mindedly reached out for him. When he jerked his arm away, I recoiled. Right, he didn't like to be touched. I'm sorry, I said.
It's not my intent to be.
You're not at all. Please don't feel the need to explain. I shouldn't be touching you. God, I didn't mean that to sound weird or creepy. Oh, just stop already. Shaking my head, I gathered up my bag. I'm gonna go. I think the last bus is in about 10 minutes.
Miss Vespertine.
At his call, I swung back around.
I'll see you tomorrow.
With a smile, I nodded. Chapter 43. Lilia. A mild ache throbbed in my arm where a bruise marked Professor Bramwell's grip. As I lay in bed, I studied the pale purple outline of his fingers, tracing their edges with my fingertip. After securing my non-bruised arm into my restraint, I flicked off the lamp beside my bed and settled into the covers. The moment I closed my eyes, I could almost feel his hand still gripping me, holding me. The curl of those strong fingers digging into my bones. The cool sheets dragged across my bare legs as I turned over to my stomach, the chain of my restraint clanking against the metal frame of the bed as it slid across the steel rail to the other side. I imagined his hand guiding mine down my body, slipping beneath the hem of my panties. Through parted lips, I let out a heavy sigh as I skated my fingers down an already wet seam.
So fucking wet.
I imagined Professor Bramwell whispering in my ear. In my mind's eye, he was bent over me, the muscles of his bare chest pressed against my back, while he ran his fingers over that excited bundle of nerves that practically purred against his fingertips. I turned my face into the pillow and darker thoughts emerged, ones where he held me by the back of my neck, warning me to come or suffocate. My fingers stroked faster, my breaths panting into the unforgiving cotton. I shoved one of my pillows between my legs, letting the firm surface press against the sensitive cleft. The bed let out a quiet squeak as I moved my hips. With my hand freed up, I pulled down my nightgown, springing my breast free. I could almost feel his palm gripping my flesh, fingers tickling my nipple, and his warm breath on my neck.
Be a good little moth, and I'll fuck you hard.
As I rubbed myself against the pillow, I imagined him pounding into me, my smaller body jostling beneath his much bigger form. The feel of his cock pushing deep inside, filling me. Hot and desperate, I pushed to my knees, propping my ass up slightly, and plunged two fingers up inside of me, shocked to discover how wet they were when I pulled them back out and plunged again. Please fuck me, my mind begged, still caught up in the fantasy of being bent over his desk. Please, Professor Bramwell, fuck me hard. My belly tightened into hot coils of need, every muscle shaking as the orgasm crashed over me, and I moaned into my pillow, loud, throaty moans that carried the lust-drunk pleasure of hard climax. I ground out the last of it into the pillow, still wedged between my legs. With my ass still propped up, I turned my face to the side, drinking in the first sip of cool air, and breathed heavy and fast. From the nightstand, I nabbed a half-consumed bottle of water and gulped it back until the sting of thirst faded with my high. Once the lingering swells of euphoria died down, I pulled the pillow from between my legs and arranged it beneath the one I'd nearly smothered myself with. The restraint clanked again as I turned back over, and when I fell back onto my bed, I stared up at the dark ceiling, still trying to catch my breath. Holy shit. I'd masturbated a few times in my life, but it had never felt quite so good as that. Groaning, I turned to my side, letting the small bit of shame settle over me. I just fingered myself to thoughts of my professor, who also happened to be my boss. He had to be at least 30-something, and while I wished that would have been a deterrent, unfortunately it only stoked the flames. Something about the man crawled beneath my skin, unraveling dark fantasies like a spool of silk ribbon. I liked that he was older, more mature. I'd always been attracted to older men. I remembered having a conversation with my mother when I was about 14, well before she had gotten sick. She'd told me that boys my age were immature and that I needed to wait until they grew up a bit. I'd carried that thought to the end of my freshman year at high school when I'd met my first real boyfriend, if I could even call him that. I'd mostly referred to him as Ghost Boy. He was a senior, about to graduate. I'd been assigned to help him with physics so that he might actually pass 12th grade. He'd spent our tutoring sessions trying to get me to jerk him off, and when he turned 18, the dynamic of our interactions changed. I'd thought it would have turned him off, knowing he could have gotten in trouble, since he'd been considered an adult and I was still a minor. On the contrary, it seemed to make him much more interested. Somehow, I'd found it a turn-on, too. He'd told me that I was more mature, smarter, more beautiful. I'd been so certain that I had fallen in love with him up until I caught him fucking another girl in the alley behind the movie theater where she'd worked at the time, a sophomore. That had marked the end of my little explorations with Ghost Boy. But the experience had unlocked something else, something much more depraved. The visual of being dominated and ravished by an older man had somehow entrenched itself into my fantasies, until Angelo had started taking notice of me. That had been about the time my fantasies had fizzled into the recesses of my head. I thought they were banished for good, until Professor Bramwell had gripped me earlier in the night. I hated to admit that I'd enjoyed his bruising grasp a bit too much. A sound roused me out of sleep, and I opened my eyes to the darkness of my bedroom. A creak of old wood echoed through the room, and I turned to see the closet door across from me cracked open. A breath caught in my chest as something shifted in the darkness there. The willowy shape of a woman stepped forward, wearing a white gown. Fiery red hair danced around her shoulders as she glided across the floor, and when she came into view, my heart caught in my throat. Mama? Eyes black as coal gave her a terrifying, demonic appearance. Pale, wrinkled hands reached out as she hobbled across the room toward me. She came to a stop alongside my bed, staring down at me with those doll's eyes, and her mouth opened wide, wider, too wide. The abnormal unhinging of her jaw had my skin pebbling with goosebumps. A tingling paralysis seized my muscles. I couldn't move. Black worms spilled from her mouth, falling onto me. A scream ripped from my throat, and I shot up in bed with a loud clank. Confused, I turned to see my arm stretched, tethered, restrained. The restraint was connected to the headboard. Yes, I did that. I restrained myself. I snapped my attention to the closet where the door stood closed. I dreamed it. Not real, only a dream. Exhaling a shaky breath, I lay back on my pillow, staring up at the ceiling again, clutching the vial of my mother's ashes that lay against my throat. Tears wobbled in my eyes. I hated these visions of her as a monster. She wasn't a monster. Not before she'd gotten sick, anyway. A dark and shadowy memory sat on the fringes of my thoughts. Echoes of screams. Nails digging into arms. Mama, please, no. I can't breathe. Eyes screwed shut, I shook my head and buried my face into the pillow. No, 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 don't look at it. Push it away, push it away. The screams faded at the same time the ache at my arm flared again. The bruise from Bramwell. My thoughts shifted to his pleading eyes and trembling muscles. The laxity on his face as he'd gripped my arm and stroked my skin. The ache withered. I unlatched my tethered arm and pressed my thumb into the bruise, desperate for the pain to keep that nightmare from earlier away. And it did. Chapter 44. Lilia. The lab coat I'd worn the last time I'd worked in the lab hung from its hook just outside of the door. I donned it, as Professor Bramwell had asked of me, and entered the code for the keypad. The door clicked open to the laboratory, where I found him typing on a laptop at one of the benches. Candles flickered about the lab, giving off an eerie feel like something out of a Jekyll and Hyde novel. I licked my lips where I'd applied the same lipstick I wore on the night of the gala, the shade that had seemed to snag his attention. Beside him stood a stereo microscope, and on the opposite side, a large glass dome held two small purple Somnix moths, which didn't cling to the walls as they should have, but lay on the floor of their cage. "New pets?" I asked, noticing the small holes in the top of the dome and the bowl of berries provided to them, and, of course, a chunk of bloody meat that had me grimacing.
"Test group 10.
He grumbled, keeping on with his typing. "These are the moths you're using to study the toxin?"
"Yes."
"Do you have names for them?" A quick examination of the moths showed enough distinctions in coloring to distinguish them. One had a white spot and the other a crooked proboscis.
"No, I don't have names for them."
He still hadn't peeled his gaze from the eyepiece. What a shame. I mean, seems like it would be bad luck not to name them individually. Brow cocked, he shot me a glance that turned into a double take. His gaze seemed to catch on my lips. Clearing his throat, he turned away again, brow furrowed, and I bit the inside of my lip, feeling victorious that he'd noticed.
"Feel free if you're so inclined."
"Me? Wow. The pressure. They have to be good names if we want the experiment to be successful, right?"
"I'm afraid the name is inconsequential."
Smiling, I turned my attention back to the moths. "By the way, what's the cat's name?"
"Bane."
"What, are you a DC fan or something?"
"No, I'm simply not a fan of curious cats that like to invade my workspace."
Without a doubt, he'd inherited the cat. Still kind of cute that he'd allowed it to stay, and had named him. Turning my attention back to the moths, I studied the unnatural kink to their wings, which brought to mind the way my mother's spine had begun to bow in the latter stages of her illness. How helpless and sad it had always made me feel, watching her hobble around in pain. A somber ache throbbed in my chest and I cleared my throat. "So, names. I think the one in the back with the white spot on its wing should be Achilles, and the one in the front with the goofy proboscis should be Patroclus." From his profile, I caught the lowering of his brows, and I chuckled, thinking about how many muscles the man must flex in a day with all those frowns.
"Is this an obsession with Greek mythology?"
"In your canonical world, I suppose it would seem that way."
"Dare I ask what it represents in your world?"
he asked, making a quick sketch in the notebook beside his microscope that appeared to be the melanization of larvae, given the dark pigmentation. As I peered down at his artwork, a small white scar just below his knuckle caught my eye and had me wondering how it had gotten there. At his abrupt pause, I glanced up to see his brow cocked in expectation and realized I hadn't answered his question. "A romance novel I read a while back." He let out a disapproving sigh.
"I'm sure it was enriching."
"You shouldn't knock romance, Professor. It so happens that love is biologically important to human beings. It reduces blood pressure and depression and improves sleep." The contemplative expression on his face twisted to a smirk.
"And just how does that benefit you as a reader? A voyeur, essentially. You have no intimate connection with these fictional characters."
"Says who? I happen to get very attached to my fictional boyfriends." Yet another frown.
"Boyfriends?"
"I read a lot." With a shake of his head, he huffed.
"Fine. Achilles and Patroclus."
He conceded. "Has a nicer ring than Test Group 10. I drew my finger over the glass, curious that the moths didn't bother to flutter off or startle at my presence. What's wrong with them? Why are they hanging out on the floor of the cage?
"They suffer with a condition that affects their ability to fly. The muscles used to contract their wings are faulty."
"And so you intend to inject them with the toxin in hopes it'll reverse it?"
"Precisely."
"Have you had success before?"
"No. The moth metabolizes the toxin before it can repair the muscles."
Then the puzzle is slowing the speed it metabolizes. How?
If I knew that, I'd be on a yacht sipping champagne instead of fielding all of your millions of questions. Again.
I smiled as the moth hobbled, trailing after my nail that I dragged across the glass. The ferry ride here was my first time on a boat. First time on the sea. I've never actually touched the water at all. In my periphery, he lifted his head from the microscope and turned to me.
You've never touched the sea?
I was always scared of it. The vastness, the power. The way it could sweep a person off their feet and carry them miles away from shore. Then you're alone and adrift in the middle of nowhere, with God knows what swimming beneath you. I stared off, imagining the visual I'd had on the ferry ride. Deep waters terrify me.
Or perhaps it's the sea who fears the depths of you, Miss Vespertine.
The amusement in his voice and dimple in his cheek told me the comment wasn't serious, but it left me wondering if there was an element of truth in his humor, if the man buried his compliments that way, or softened his insults behind handsome smiles and poetic words. That's ridiculous, I played along. The sea doesn't fear anything. Turning back toward the moths, I fought the urge to smile. Well, these moths are named, therefore this experiment cannot fail.
If you say so.
Eyes still peering through the microscope, he reached for the notebook beside him and handed it to me.
I've detailed a list of chores for you.
A small post-it flag stuck out from the side, labeled Vespertine, and I opened the book up to a list of illegible scribbles. Jesus, did you have to take a class to write this bad? He let out a disapproving grumble.
Keep in mind it's you who wants this job, not the other way around.
I chuckled to myself, trying to decipher the first chore on the list, and got to work on the menial tasks I'd specifically requested not to do. The hours passed quickly, and once again it was time to go. Just as he had the night before, he walked me to the bus stop. A sharp tension rattled my nerves, recalling the last we'd walked together and he'd collapsed in front of me, without warning.
No millions of questions tonight?
He asked, staring up at the stars as we strolled across the yard. Smiling, I lowered my gaze. Okay, fine. Remember, though, you asked for it.
I take full responsibility.
You seem kind of young for a tenured professor with a medical degree. What's up with that?
I was fast-tracked. It pays to have the right connections. Remember that.
I bit the inside of my cheek, debating whether or not to ask the next question. One that had toyed with my mind for days, and I wouldn't have been ballsy enough to ask out of the blue. But since he was actually entertaining questions, why not? Why did you carry me to your car that night? You could have left me in the gardens. Someone might have found me. When he glanced back at me, his brow did that painfully attractive kicking up thing.
Had I known you were going to blackmail me, I might have.
I chuckled. You don't strike me as a man who's easily blackmailed.
And you don't strike me as a young woman who longs to sequester herself in an antiquated lab with cadavers and parasites either. Yet, here we are.
The smile on my face faded as I contemplated why I was still so drawn to this after my mother's death, why my curiosities had so much of a chokehold over me. I feel compelled to do something meaningful with my life. I owe it to my family.
You owe nothing to your family,
he said abrasively, as if I'd insulted him.
Passions are useless if we pursue them for others. They become obligations, undesirable.
This project is your passion?
I suppose, in spite of all the political bullshit.
He glanced over at me.
What's yours?
It was a question I'd answered so many times, on applications and in interviews, and my benign response of wanting to help people was always the same. But that wasn't true either, and in light of his last comment, I got the sense he'd see right through it. So I answered honestly. I don't know. I guess I'm still searching for it. I love science, I love learning, and I want to cure Noctisoma someday. Put you out of business.
Good luck.
It was clear from the way his lips twitched that he was holding back a smile.
To answer your question about why I didn't leave you in the gardens that night, I find you to be an intriguing annoyance.
I guess that's appropriate, coming from a man I find to be brilliantly antisocial, I quipped. The crease at the corner of his eye hinted at the slightest smile. Man, the guy was stingy when it came to them.
I suppose that's fair. I have a gift for repelling.
I snorted and shook my head. Not the brunette who sits in front of me in class, I blurted.
And what about her?
I instantly regretted having brought her up. She seems to be very... An image came to mind of 2 days before when she'd snapped a photo of him rolling up his sleeves before lecture, with the caption, "Professor Hand Necklace, Tongue Emoji." Observant during your lectures. I dared a glance and found him staring at the ground, frowning, his hands tucked into his pockets, sleeves rolled up over those exquisite forearms she'd captured in her photo. "She's pretty," I added, gauging his reaction. "Seems your type." A short distance away, the headlights of the bus flickered as it approached my stop.
"Hardly. I don't have a defined type, particularly when it comes to my students."
"She'll be thoroughly disappointed, I'm sure." At that point, I didn't even know if I was talking about the girl anymore. Under different circumstances, she might have been the perfect match.
"Under different circumstances."
The pause in his words carried a laborious heartbeat that smothered my own as I watched the slightest smile play on his lips. A beat of hesitation.
"I might have pursued you."
A nervous rush of breath escaped me. I gripped the strap of my book bag in some faulty attempt to hold my composure and swallowed past the dryness in my throat. "And I might have let you." The bus rolled to a stop, absolutely killing the moment, if it counted as a moment. "Good night, Professor."
"Good night, Miss Vespertine."
Chapter 45. Lilia. What? I stared down at my first entomology exam, trying to make sense of the grade that had been populated into the computer. 45 points out of 80, which equated to a 56%. I hadn't received a 56% on an exam since middle school. Scrolling through the document that I'd submitted showed pages and pages of red notes alongside my essays. And at first, the grade almost seemed legit for all the red. Until I scanned over them. The notes marked ridiculous technical errors, like a comma that should have been a semicolon, a paragraph that Gilchrist felt should have been new, except that the information had related to the previous paragraph and I had apparently not tabbed over enough on my bullet points to her liking. Cheeks red hot, I held back the urge to cry as I waited for the class to end. I'd have loved to compare grades with another student, but the only other person I knew was Spencer, who hadn't bothered to show up, and I had no interest in interacting with him after the events at the gala. Although he'd attempted to call me since then, I'd ignored him. Once class ended, a small line formed, as other students waited to speak with Professor Gilchrist, and I patiently waited my turn, in spite of wanting to crawl out of my skin right then. When I finally reached the front, I stepped forward, my hand shaking with the anger that had blossomed over the last hour.
"How can I help you, Miss Vespertine?"
Her voice held an air of boredom that only goaded my frustration. "My grade, it seems, content-wise, all of my essays and multiple-choice responses were correct."
"Mm-hmm. And?"
"I received a 56 on grammatical and formatting errors. You never specified the importance of these issues and how much they weighed on the grade." The unbothered expression on her face didn't waver with my complaint. If anything, it grew smugger.
"It's a college course. You should be well-versed in how to format a proper essay."
"I understand, but 56? I mean, I got every answer correct. I understood the material, and you had no comments on the composition and content of my essays." Shoulders rolled back, she rested her elbows on the desk, entwining her fingers.
"Tell me, do you intend to conduct research someday?"
"Yes."
"Yes."
Her brows winged up with a smile that was both pitiful and condescending at the same time.
"And so, grant writing is a huge part of funding for those research projects. If you can't format properly, well, you look inept."
She threw her hands up dismissively. Dismissively doling out a grade that weighed heavily on my cumulative score.
"That would make sense, if this was a grant writing class. Please tell me you're not one of those students who feels a sense of entitlement based on your circumstances."
"Excuse me?" I cleared my throat, the shock of her words rendering me stupefied. The haughty tip of her chin told me I hadn't misheard her nor misunderstood the meaning.
"I'm not trying to be difficult," I added. I'm just concerned what this will do to my overall average. It'll certainly bring it down, which is a shame. It seems the underprivileged aren't meant for a proud and dignified institution like Dracadia. I was wrong about you. How so? Her finger tapped on the lid of her black coffee cup. I saw you glancing over at Spencer twice during this exam. You're lucky I didn't fail you for cheating. Cheating? Cheating? The accusation struck me like a punch to the throat. I'd spent hours studying for that exam. I do not cheat, and if I ever thought of cheating, it certainly wouldn't be off Spencer. On a mirthless laugh, she shook her head. You are an arrogant little thing, aren't you? So smug and full of yourself. What? I'm not... I don't understand. I swear to you, I never cheated. I wouldn't cheat. I hated that my voice wobbled with the threat of tears. I want to do well while I'm here. I'm sure you do. And I'm sure your manipulative behaviors work on some professors here at Dracadia, Miss Vespertine. But I'm not one of them. The arrogant smile that followed sank into my gut like a rusty fork. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have an important meeting. The grade stands. A cold despair stirred in my chest as I exited her class. I'd planned to get lunch at Kavik, but decided the best thing for me to do was head back to my dorm to sleep it off. Exhaustion and anger weighed heavy on me, and I still had two more afternoon classes to get through. As I rounded the building past the small alley, something grabbed my arm, and a hard yank had me stumbling backward into a solid surface. I opened my mouth to scream, but a hand smothered it, and my body was dragged backward toward the alley. Once there, the hard stones of the building smashed into my spine. Spencer stood before me, one eye swollen and purple, both eyes red with deep black circles beneath. His body shook, his lip downturned as if he would cry. I let out a scream, and he pressed his hand harder, his jaw clenching with frustration.
Please, listen to me. Just for a moment, I'm begging you.
My heart hammered in my chest as I stared back, wondering what he would do. Was he crazy enough to strangle me? Angry enough to punch me?
I know you think that I tried to hurt you that night, and I swear to you, Lilia, I didn't. I wouldn't hurt you, ever.
His voice was shaky, as if he were on the brink of cracking.
There are things you don't know about. People who are very bad here, and Professor Bramwell is one of them. Do you understand?
I didn't bother to shake my head or nod at his comment.
He beat the shit out of me that night. He did this to my fucking eye.
At that, I did try to shake my head, and he pressed into me, lips snarled up in rage.
Yes, he did. I fucking saw him. He took off that fucking mask, and he beat the ever-living shit out of me. And no one believes me. Not Langmore, not my fucking father, not even you.
He lowered his gaze, eyes shining with tears.
Did I have intentions that night? No.
Eyes screwed shut. He shook his head.
Yeah, how could I not, with how you looked in that dress? But I did not drug you. I wouldn't do that. Not to you.
I kicked my head to the side, and he lowered his hand from my mouth. Did you drug Mel? His brows came together, and he let out a huff.
Yes, but it's not what you think. I was just trying to find out what she knew about Jenny and Bramwell. I just needed her to relax a little.
Did you try to have sex with her?
I flirted. Tried to kiss her is all. Again, it was just trying to get her to talk to me.
She was telling the truth then. You really are a scumbag. Fingers curling into my arms, he held me tighter.
I didn't do this shit because I wanted to. I did it because I had to.
What the hell does that even mean? Your dad put you up to drugging her? The expression on his face blackened, and a cold brush of alarm palmed the back of my neck.
I told you, there are bad people at this school. Some worse than others.
I saw you with Gilchrist. I saw her touch you. A look of shame crumpled his brow, and he lowered his gaze from mine. You kissed her.
She threatened to fail me if I didn't.
He grimaced and exhaled a shaky breath, the repulsion crimping his lips. If you didn't what? Tears shone in his eyes as he shook his head. Spencer, if you didn't, what? Was it Gilchrist who put you up to all of this? He looked toward the mouth of the alley and back to me, his hand frantically stroking my hair.
I like you, Lilia. A lot. Too much. I can't stop thinking about you. and it kills me to know that you hate me right now.
I don't hate you. I just really need you to tell me the truth.
If you care for me, even the slightest bit, even as a friend, you'll stay away from Bramwell.
What are you talking about? He's my professor.
I see him watching you sometimes. You don't even realize how much he watches you. He's followed you to class. He's probably watching you now, for fuck's sake. The guy is nuts.
Undoubtedly wearing the confusion that clouded my brain, I shook my head.
Yes, he does. Watch yourself, Lilia. In fact, fucking leave this school. You're better off.
Placing a palm at my throat, he didn't squeeze, only stroked the column of my neck with his thumb. His face pinched, as if he might cry right there. Instead, he darted off back down the alley. A strange vulnerability settled over me as I walked down the cadaver tunnel toward Professor Bramwell's lab. Even though I'd spent the afternoon convincing myself that Spencer was wrong, that I had watched Bramwell enough to know that he hadn't been watching me like that, his arguments still left me confused. Spencer clearly had it in for Bramwell, and while his friend being kicked out seemed reason enough to suspect he might harbor some animosity toward him, to what extent would that animosity go? That he would frame Bramwell as an attacker? Make him out to be a total creep who followed me around? As if my problems weren't already stacked like a Jenga tower ready to tumble, B's school had called me earlier, letting me know they could only get half of the back tuition approved with the grant, and that I'd have to get them 500 as soon as possible. 500 I didn't happen to have right then. Feeling pummeled by the day's events, I entered the lab and found Professor Bramwell hunched over, studying something on the bench he stood before. A candle flickered near him as he poked a set of forceps toward the benchtop. It was enough distraction to banish the thoughts of Spencer and Bee and Gilchrist and every other woe that had reared its ugly head. At the brush of my ankles, I knelt down to give Bane a quick pet, grateful for his sweet little greeting on such a shitty day, and I approached Professor Bramwell to see it was a moth he had spread out on the extra-wide stage plate of the microscope, its thorax sliced open to reveal the organs beneath. He lifted a long, skinny black worm up into the air where it wriggled and thrashed around. Professor tipped his head and grabbed another set of forceps, which he used to hold one end of it still while he examined the parasite.
Son of a bitch.
What is it? I asked, intrigued by the awe in his voice.
Another one with teeth.
Teeth? He laid it beside the moth, restraining the end of it. And when he shifted it beneath the lens, I peered up at the small square viewing screen to see tiny fang-like structures snapping at the forceps.
It seems they've evolved.
You're telling me those things? The thought of it curled my guts. Probably didn't help that I'd skipped both lunch and dinner after what had happened earlier.
Yes, they can apparently latch now.
He lifted the worm and plopped it into a jar of clear fluid and placed a cap over it. From beside him, he lifted the burning candle, holding it over the moth as if looking for more of the worms. At the angle he held it, the flame flickered over his knuckles, and I frowned as it seemed to have no effect on him. He didn't move, didn't even flinch, as if he couldn't feel it. Professor! I lurched toward him, and he startled, knocking the jar with the worm onto the floor where the glass shattered. The worm wriggled across the tiles toward a drain.
No! Shit!
He jogged toward it, sliding over the slick tiles, but caught himself and planted his shoe over the drain. The worm slid up onto his shoe, lifting its upper half, which it tapped against the leather's surface.
Hand me the forceps.
I sprang toward the bench and swiped up the forceps, slipping on the small bit of water like he had moments ago. He leapt back toward me, catching my arm before I fell and pulled me upright. Momentarily stunned, I stole a moment to catch my breath, and at the same time both of us snapped our heads in the direction of the worm, only catching its tail end as it slipped down the drain. He let out a sigh.
Fuck.
I'm so sorry. I didn't mean... Perhaps it was exhaustion coupled with hunger, and add in the fact that I'd just disappointed him, but my voice shook and I blinked away tears. As if realizing he still held my arm, he frowned and stepped back, stuffing his hands into his lab coat.
What's wrong with you?
I shook my head, not wanting to tell him, because telling him would have definitely made me cry, and I was not crying in front of the man. I'll clean up this mess. As I stepped in the direction of the utility closet, he sidestepped and blocked me.
Lilia, tell me what's wrong.
A strange feeling stirred in my chest on hearing him say my name. and when I lifted my gaze to his, saw the concern brimming in his eyes, I couldn't hold back the tears. I can't.
Tell me. No.
Why did I protect Gilchrist? Had she given me even a fraction of consideration when she'd said those things earlier? No. In fact, it probably tickled her black heart to know how much her words had crushed me. The way she'd somehow seen right through me and reached down into the deepest pits of my self-doubt. Gilchrist accused me of cheating on an exam. She gave me a 56 on it. His eye twitched, jaw hardened.
Did she know?
I don't know if she plans to pursue the cheating accusation, but if she does, then that will ruin everything. I'll be kicked out and I won't be approved for next semester.
Relax. She would need proof.
While the confidence in his tone cut through my worry like a jagged blade, it didn't settle it entirely. She accused me of cheating off Spencer. She's threatened to fail Spencer before. He's not going to tell the truth for my sake. He snorted.
As if Spencer held a candle.
He trailed off in a grouchy grumble. I didn't know why that half-comment filled me with satisfaction and withered some of the mire in my head. Maybe because the man rarely threw out compliments. Or perhaps it was because I felt like he was on my side.
It takes tremendous effort to prove a student has cheated, and I don't think she has the energy or motivation for that.
The relief I felt in telling him just that small piece of my day left me wanting to offload everything, every miserable detail, until I'd purged and emptied myself of it. But I wouldn't. He didn't need to know my financial woes on top of everything else. The man probably had more money than he knew what to do with. The fact that I owed thousands for B's tuition with a mere $10 left in my account would have probably seemed absurd to him. To all the students who attended this university, too. I'd yet to meet one weighed down by their finances the way I was. Sometimes I think coming here was a mistake. I just feel like everything is stacked against me all the time. There's no winning.
And so, what? You go back to Covington?
I don't know. I don't want to, but even if I paid B's school the 200 Bramwell had agreed to give me every week, it'd still take over 2 months to pay everything back, and that was assuming Connor kept up his half to bring the account current. Everything just feels so heavy sometimes.
So your solution is to quit school, forego your scholarship.
As I said, I don't want to do that, but
but nothing. You may be smart, but you sure as fuck say foolish things.
I could have given him some benefit of doubt, not knowing what was going through my head right then, that Gilchrist was only one of many worries. But his response still pissed me off. People with money somehow always pissed me off, and I hated myself for that. But goddamn it, sometimes they acted like their problems were on par with everyone else's. What would he have thought had he known that I'd uploaded a fucking porn video to a website just to pay for my sister's tuition? Would he have judged me for that? Lectured me on virtue and human decency? Since when do you care? I'm sure you'll appreciate going back to your quiet lab where no one breaks jars and lets specimens escape down the drain. I don't belong at this school with students who drop hundreds on dresses for one night, who can afford their fancy latte coffees in cute little cups with the gold dragon logo, I said, giving a snobby flip of my wrist, who don't have to think about anything but their grades and studying. I'm tired of stressing about things that never cross their minds.
So going back to Covington is going to relieve you of all these struggles?
Of course not, but everyone in Covington struggles. At least I'm not some freak outcast there.
Yes, brilliant. You'll be thrown into some shit job that you'll hate and resent for the rest of your life.
What does it matter to you if I stay or not? I searched those usually apathetic eyes for some explanation for why he suddenly seemed bothered.
It matters.
Why?
Has anyone treated you like scum here? Has anyone thrown your lack of money in your face?
Gilchrist came to mind. Her comment from earlier that it apparently sunk its claws into me, given the way I was feeling right then, but I didn't bother to mention it. Instead, I kept my lips shut, which he apparently took as a response to his question.
Stop feeling sorry for yourself. You sound ridiculous.
I sound ridiculous? Why? Because I don't share the same problems as the rich elite?
No, that you bother to compare yourself to them at all is ridiculous.
Ah, yes. I almost forgot they were in a different league. Thank you for yanking me back down to reality. Tears formed in my eyes as I dared to confess what had ground at me all afternoon. Perhaps Gilchrist was right when she said the underprivileged aren't meant for a proud and dignified institution like Dracadia. Scorn darkened his eyes.
She said that to you?
As much as I regretted having said it aloud, it felt good to have told someone, to offload some of the humiliation still chipping at my pride. Yes, after she accused me of being entitled based on my circumstances. So tell me again why I sound ridiculous, why I have no right to compare myself to my fellow students, why I shouldn't go back to where I belong. His jaw shifted, lip curled in disgust.
Because you're better than them, stronger. And unfortunately, you'll have to fight harder for what you want. But you have an understanding of things beyond their comprehension. You're exceptional, Lilia. And by God, if you waste that intellect on the ignorant words of an envious shrew like Loretta Gilchrist, it will be the most egregious offense you've ever committed.
Heat burned my face red hot. My arms shook with the urge to throw them around him and kiss him. Instead, I stared, focusing on the unsteady breaths that sawed in and out of me. The suffocating tension between us threatened to ignite on one bold move, a single strike of a match. His hand curled around the bench where he leaned, and it was then I noticed the glossy red mark and inflamed skin where he'd burned himself with the candle. Oh my God. I reached out for his hand, and he jerked it away, holding his fist at his chest. You're burned pretty badly. You need to clean and wrap that.
I know what I need.
Right, I said, taking a step back. Of course, he'd probably done clinical rotations in the ER and burn units at some point in his life. Can you not feel at all?
No, not at all.
I can't imagine how awful that must be. How terrifying not to feel. He lowered his hand, flexing his fingers.
It's grown on me.
You've suffered with that your whole life?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
I don't need your pity, Miss Vespertine.
His voice hardened, the space between us colder all of a sudden.
If you'd be so kind as to clean up the broken glass, I'd appreciate it. Be careful not to cut yourself.
Of course. For the next 2 hours, I busied myself with menial lab tasks, autoclaving, sterilizing new agar solution, and catching the occasional glance from Professor Bramwell, like the night of the gala, stolen glances amounting to nothing, really. Nothing but curiosity. I thought back to the evening before when he'd told me that under different circumstances he'd have pursued me. Whatever had compelled him to confess that must have slinked back into its shell and covered itself up with a blanket. As I wiped down the fume hood, I noticed a tray of tubes carrying a strange purple and black solution. Frowning, I turned my head to the side, reading the vertical label on the test tubes. Nixver 2.10, Nixver 2.12, Nixver 2.15. Beneath that was Noctosoma toxin and the date. Pretending as if I was scrubbing hard at something, I studied the strange fluid inside, the almost marbled mixture of purple and black that must have been what he planned to inject into the moths. At the end of my shift, Dr. Bramwell walked me to the bus stop, wordless. Shoulders bunched, gaze glued to the ground. He seemed preoccupied. And I supposed I was too tired to bombard him with questions, so the two of us walked in silence. Just like the last time, he watched me from a distance until I caught the flicker of bus lights coming up over the hill, and I waved him on. Hands stuffed in his pockets, he turned around and headed back toward his lab. Drops of rain hit my arm, and when I tipped my head back, cold sprinkles dotted my face. Perfect. Fortunately, the bus was close, because the longer I stood there, the faster the drops fell. Faster, faster. When the bus finally reached me, the rain had picked up intensity, pattering hard against the sidewalk. It was then I realized I'd left my purse and my ID back at the lab. Shit, shit. I'd need it to get into my dorm. Shit, shit. Groaning, I waved the bus driver on, and as the downpour assaulted me along the way, striking my skin like dissolving bullets, I jogged my ass back toward the laboratory until I reached the incinerator room, where I shook off the